Turning this evening to the book of Numbers, chapter 25 and verse 1. Numbers 25, verse 1. And Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. And our subject is lessons before the entry into Canaan. We're coming to the end of our survey of the book of Numbers, and I'd like to raise with you from these closing chapters four lessons which have obvious application to us, four themes which you find in them. And the first will be sins of peace. In a sense, there was peace now. Moab was not to be attacked by Israel. The children of Israel knew that. The Moabites didn't seem to know that. And they had surveyed the Israelite force and realized they could not defeat it. And so they'd hired Balaam to present a curse against the Israelites, and he had failed to do so. But he had given them cunning counsel, which he had derived, no doubt, from Satan, whether he was aware of it or not. And the counsel was, don't fight them, corrupt them, infiltrate them, bring them down, infiltrate them with beautiful women, cause them to commit whoredom, fornication with those women, and to adopt the gods of Moab and the gods of the Midianites. And by doing this, they will lose the blessing of their God, and they will lose their strength, and they will be indifferent to their distinctiveness and the battle which their leader Moses would otherwise bring upon them. And that was the policy that was adopted. And it's that the policy of Balaam is the satanic policy which has been in use down the running centuries of time by Satan against the churches of Christ. There are times of physical persecution, and there are times of infiltration and corruption of the churches. And so this is the policy that abides today. You read about it right through the Bible and in the book of Revelation, and it's warned about particularly in the message and the letter to the church at Pergamos, this doctrine of Balaam, infiltration and corruption. And it was highly effective then, and tragically it's been highly effective in church life ever since. The Midianites too. Now, they were not protected as the Moabites were. However, their land was not part of what was given to the Israelites. They had no interest in it. And if the Midianites had conducted themselves calmly and peacefully, they would never have been under threat from Israel. But again, they didn't seem to know that. But they went in with Moab in the same policy of infiltration and corruption. So really, these are sins of peace. There was no likelihood at that particular time of attack, either from Moab or from the Midianites. They had chosen instead peaceful infiltration and contamination of the children of Israel. Then it was by beautiful women. And of course, first of all, there was the scheme to bring down the families of Israel through fornication and then turn them to the idol gods of Moab and the Midianites. Now it's rather different. The infiltration in our age comes via things that are distinctively worldly, and the revolution against God in this world and all the means that are used to promote it. Characteristic music and movies and even food and leisure and indulgence and participation in the things of this world. Images that can be seen in every home, at every desk, to corrupt and to bring down. And that is the devil's method here. There is physical persecution in many lands against the church, and there is infiltration and contamination in lands where there seems to be peace. And actually, it's far more successful. Where there is physical persecution, there are always considerable numbers of believers who, no matter what it costs them and how much imprisonment and how much torture and punishment and oppression, stand firm. But when it comes to infiltration and contamination, even believers seem to fall on every hand, as they are, to worldliness and worldly things. And it's always been like that. Strangely, the sins of the church in what you might like to call peacetime, when there is not physical oppression, are always much more extensive and serious than in wartime, when there's physical persecution. And that is what you see going on here. So the first verses of chapter 25. And Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. And they called the people unto the sacrifices of their gods. And Matthew Henry so long ago said, they that break the barriers of modesty will never be held by the ties of loyalty to God. And it's true. You watch the wrong images and you sin in your heart, then very soon you'll be unfaithful in your belief and your devotion and in your service to the Lord. The one leads to the other. Verse 2 follows verse 1. Begins with whoredom. It proceeds into disloyalty. So if there's moral indulgence and fall, and you listen to the music that will corrupt your mind, and watch the movies that will corrupt your mind, then you will loosen your hold on piety and spiritual loyalty and the things of God. And that you see happening in the churches. You see even elders and deacons everywhere saying that a stand for truth no longer matters. And as long as people teach some truth, we'll overlook all the wrong things they teach. It's extraordinary what you see these days, and it's borne out. So the snares of the world have brought down more churches than have ever been brought down by physical persecution. And that you see in this 25th chapter. So plague comes, verse 3. Israel joined himself unto Baal Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And if you glance down to verse 8, you see that that came in the form of plague. Very end of the verse, so the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. And that's the comment on this passage elsewhere in the Bible. Well, they were punished. And they were not only punished by God, but God evidently gave Moses a clear instruction to punish as a magistrate even the meek and the gentle Moses. Verse 5, and Moses said unto the judges of Israel, slay ye every one his men that were joined unto Baal Peor, that gave way to the gods of the Moabites and the Midianites, and they are to be slain. And that's the earlier command of God, that that should take place and that should happen. But I come down to verses 6 to 8, and here is an incident. And behold, one of the children of Israel came and brought unto his brethren a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel, who were weeping before the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. I see in my mind's eye a band of interceders, perhaps more godly people, and a great assembly of them at the door of the tabernacle. And they're weeping for the sins of the people, and they're praying. That is what I think is going on. And then they see brought to them a particular woman. And similarly, there is going to be a man brought. Why is there this incident of one man, an Israelite, and this woman, a Midianitish woman, brought for individual judgment when the judgment has gone out upon all? Probably it is because they are sinning blatantly even after the word has gone out that all wrongdoers are going to be punished in this way. They don't seem to care. They seem to think they're immune from this. And some godly people find them, round them up. Why should they think they are immune? Well, it turns out that the man is a prince of Israel. He's a nobleman among Israel and a leader. And it turns out that the woman is a Midian princess, probably, of a noble family. Well, it says she's from a noble family in the narrative. They are significant people. They're people who evidently feel above the law. So they think they will never be charged. They will never be taken. They're used to being overlooked, to getting away with what they wish. And they are brought, and they are going to be made an example of. Verse 7, when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose up, took a javelin, went after the man, the prince, who was an offender, thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman. So the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. When judgment reached the nobility and the people who considered themselves above the law, then the Lord stayed the plague. And verse 9, 24,000 perished. This is the last bad event before the children of Israel enter into the land of Canaan. And there's a great commendation for Phinehas. Verse 10, the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, and so on, hath turned away my wrath from the children of Israel. And so, verse 12, he's given the covenant of peace, and he shall have it and his seed after him. The enduring priesthood is going to be descended from him. That's the special privilege and blessing. And he's applauded. And then there are the details from verse 14 of the noble backgrounds of the two offenders. So here you get God's strongest commendation upon the man who acted to defend the faith, to defend the church, to defend God's honour and his holiness and the principles. Dear friends, every one of us should one day hope to have the commendation of God for having defended the faith and defended godliness and defended the churches. That's what's involved. I hope there isn't anybody here who will go on to become a flabby, flaccid believer, not minding about serious wrongdoing, denial of the faith. You see it constantly. I hear it all the time, even leaders in churches, and they don't mind, as I said before, what people are teaching, what they're saying. Well, I hope you won't be like that. Sometimes people are very zealous when they're in their 20s and in their 30s. They get to their late 30s and they don't mind anymore. And into their 40s and they're almost different people. And no longer will they stand. And no longer will they defend the truth. Pray that you'll never be like that. Well, Phinehas has this tremendous recommendation. And then verse 16 of chapter 25, the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, vex the Midianites. They weren't to be in the line of fire, but they've done a terrible thing against the Lord and his church. And now the judgment of God upon these evil people is that they are to be destroyed. Verse 18, for they vex you with their wiles, the wiles of the devil. Paul uses an equivalent term in the Greek in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 11, the wiles of the devil. They vex you with their wiles, wherewith they have beguiled you in the matter of Peor, the Midianite god, and those offending people. And then chapter 26, we move on to this now. And it came to pass after the plague that the Lord spake unto Moses and unto Eleazar, saying, take the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel from 20 years old and upward. It is the second great census. This is why the book is called the Book of Numbers. There is the census 38 years previously, and there's the census which takes place now. This is the generation of people aged between 20 and 60, or from including 20, 60 or so, who will enter the land. The previous entire generation has been excluded. So now there is to be another count, and that's recorded here in chapter 20, or referred to at the beginning of chapter 26, and then you get all the details, and it's the census in the plains of Moab. But I'm coming down, there's a long list of the families and the numbers, and the totals appear in verse 51 of chapter 26. 601,730 people plus 23,000 Levites. And then there's reference to the dividing of the land. But I come all the way down now, chapter 27, dealing with the laws of inheritance, so that the daughters can inherit as well as sons when there are no sons. But all the way down to chapter 27 and verse 12, let us say. And the Lord said unto Moses, get thee up into this Mount Abarim and see the land which I have given unto the children of Israel. And when thou hast seen it, thou also shalt be gathered unto thy people, as Aaron thy brother was gathered. Why will Moses not go into the land? Well, we've seen this before. It's the judgment of God upon him. Verse 14 of chapter 27, for ye rebelled against my commandment in the desert of Zin. Now, the second theme or point which is coming up now really concerns types of Christ. Moses is a type of Christ. He disobeyed God in the water at Meribah, in Kadesh, in the wilderness of Zin. And Moses actually appealed, so we read in Deuteronomy, to God to allow him to forgive him and allow him to go into the land. But God would not hear his appeal. Moses had to be deprived of something. And he would have an honorable retirement and death, but he would be deprived of that wonderful earthly experience of actually leading the people into the promised land. Moses is not going to be made an exception. For a moment, he wavered, and he was guilty of unbelief, and he disobeyed God, and so he must be counted with the unbelieving generation in this respect. But that's not the whole reason why he's excluded from the land. There's also a theological reason, and it is this. Moses is a type of Christ. They're now going into the promised land. The history of the Israelites is typical, and it typifies entry into the glorious hereafter, entry into heaven. This is theological predictive history. And so the one who is their shepherd and their leader and their guide must not be tainted. And so Joshua will lead them in. There's a theological reason as well as a practical reason. If Moses is made an exception of, and there is no example of God's disapproval upon him for his moment of disobedience, well then, that will lead to disrespect for God's commands. But the one in this predictive history, predictive of Christ, who leads the people into the land, must be clean, as Christ is spotless and blameless. Now we know that Joshua was not a blameless, perfect man. But as a typical leader, he starts with a clean sheet, and therefore he represents Christ, the perfect mediator who came and entered heaven for us as our forerunner after his atoning work and his offering of righteousness. Moses was now tainted. He couldn't be allowed the privilege of being a type of Christ into the land, so it's the time for him to be honourably retired and for Joshua to come in with a clean sheet. So there's a practical reason to preserve the honour of God, and there's a theological reason that the predictive history must be right. And the one who leads God's people into the land of promise will be unblemished as he does so. And so that's the double reason why Moses is laid aside and Joshua enters in. Now we look down to chapter 27 and verse 15. And Moses spake unto the Lord, saying, Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, a beautiful phrase which he's used before in addressing God, let the Lord set a man over the congregation which may go out before them and which may go in before them and which may lead them out and which may bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord be not a sheep which have no shepherd. You know, in the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 9 and verse 36, and also in the Gospel of Mark, parallel passage, this is spoken by Christ. He is the one who is so full of feeling for the multitude when they are a sheep without a shepherd. He is the good shepherd. But look at verse 17. This is not Moses' idea. You could read it that way and you'd be wrong to do so. Moses has had a good idea. And he says in verse 16, let the Lord set a man over the congregation. This isn't a prayer of request from Moses. It is a prayer of affirmation of what Moses knows God is going to do. He knows that God will appoint another. He's been told before he will not enter into the land. God has spoken of them always having a leadership. And so Moses is not asking, he's affirming. You see his great meekness. When it's clear to him that God will not pardon him this thing and allow him to lead the people in, he says it by way of affirmation. Well then, let the Lord set a man over the congregation. Let it be done, he's saying. He submits entirely and graciously. A man which may go before them. Predictive history of Christ, who goes before his people, purchases salvation for them, suffers on Calvary for their sins, offers up his perfect righteousness for them, by his Spirit regenerates and draws them and saves them and leads them all the way to glory. And the people of God in those typical days would have such a leader that they would not be as sheep, having no shepherd. All the tenderness of Christ is predicted in that verse. And then verse 18, the Lord said unto Moses, take thee Joshua, the appointment is made by God, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay thine hand upon him. Not to impart the Spirit, he already has the Spirit, but to pass the mantle and authorize him to exercise his Spirit and his God-given leadership. And there'll be a complete handover and a solemn charge, which is a model, in a way, for churches today. And that's the type of Joshua. I must rush on because time is passing quickly. Chapters 28 and 29, there's a summary of the offerings and feasts that the people will make in the Promised Land. Most of them have already been given, detailed. Chapter 20, and in the book of Exodus, chapter 29. Some are newly disclosed here to the people of God. And then chapter 30, the rules for vows and for promises. But chapter 31 brings us to our third point, third theme, which I'll look at briefly, and it is that the people of God are appointed for war. Look at verse 31. now the attack on the Midianites. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Avenge the children of Israel of the Midianites. Afterward shalt thou be gathered unto thy people. One last campaign for Moses. And there is of every tribe to be brought 1,000. And Israelites had been punished for falling for the cunning of the Moabites and the Midianites. 24,000 people had committed great sin and had perished, but now the Midianites are to be punished also. Look down to verse 7 of chapter 31. It sometimes worries people. And they warred against the Midianites, as the Lord commanded Moses, and they slew all the males, and they slew the kings of Midian, or the princes of Midian. And they slew them all, and then they took captives from the wives and the children. Verse 9, too many captives, and they burnt the cities. Chapter 31 and verse 10. Now, when you look at verse 10, it's very interesting. They burnt all their cities wherein they dwelt, and all their goodly castles with fire. And here's a clue. They didn't destroy all the Midianites. They seemed to have attacked only or chiefly the fighting cities, the defensive cities, where the real militants were, the people who wouldn't flee, the people who wouldn't appeal for peace, perhaps the frontier cities or townships, the fighting, the military garrisons and strongholds, because vast numbers of Midianites survived. And we have to interpret all the males and assume that we're talking about all the males in the militant frontier border defensive cities. And we can establish that quite easily by turning just for a moment, and you may wish to do so, to the book of Judges in chapter 6. And here in Judges chapter 6 and verses 1 to 4, I'll read a little passage to you. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. Oh, the Midianites are still there. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. They're very powerful, they're very numerous, and they're very strong. And because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them the dens, which are in the mountains, and caves, and strongholds. They ran and hid. And so it was, when Israel had sown, that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites, and the children of the east, even they came up against them, and they encamped against them, and destroyed the increase of the earth, till thou come unto Gaza, and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass, and so on. And verse 6, Israel was greatly impoverished. And then God raises up Gideon, and there's a mighty battle. And the Midianites are so numerous, they stretch across a whole valley, although Gideon's forces were reduced by God to a mere 300. And there was a miraculous defeat of them. But the point is this, they were still there. And so when you read that all the males were destroyed by Moses before they entered the promised land, clearly it refers to those castled or garrisoned or fighting towns. And that's something you have to note often in the Old Testament conquest, the Israelites of the Canaanites, that the alls do not evidently literally mean all, because in the case of most of the Canaanite tribes, you find the same thing, that the survivors are later shown to have been extremely numerous, and therefore you realize that this is about the most aggressive ones, the militant ones, the garrison towns along the border, of which, where the fighting was, of which these things are said. And that often helps you to see. But we're appointed for war. This is a spiritual warfare for us, against sin, our own personal sin, a war against Satan, a battle for souls, a war against false teaching and all detraction from God's inspired word, a war against infiltration. We are always in a battle. We're children of love and compassion, and we're reaching out to people, and we're turning the other cheek. But nevertheless, we are in a war all our lives. And we remember that, and you find that here. We won't give in. Dear friends, those of you who go a lot on the internet and you tune in to the celebrity preachers, be very careful what you do. Some of them say many right things, and they say many wrong things also. Be so careful. There are celebrity preachers that have a fine reputation, and they're up to the neck in Catholic mysticism and Catholic meditational techniques and things like this. And the principles of C.S. Lewis and many others. Their teaching is hopelessly mixed in different ways. So do be careful. We're in a war, and we must almost always defend the truth. Well, there are rules for the return of the victors after the defeat of the Midianite princes. Their return to camp, chapter 31, verses 19 and 20. Time is rushing on. And do ye abide without the camp 7 days. Whosoever hath killed any person, and whosoever hath touched any slain, purify both yourselves and your captives on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. And all the elaborate ritual washing, purify all your raiment, and all that is made of skins, and all work of goat's hair, and all things made of wood. And this is the ordinance of the law, says Eleazar at the end of verse 21. Only the gold and the silver, the brass, iron, tin, and lead, things which will survive the fire, verse 23 of chapter 31, you may have, and everything else must be destroyed. Verse 24, washing of the clothes so that you're clean, and so on. Why all the ritual cleansings? It's a great lesson. You must not bring back from your excursion into Canaanite circles and towns and villages and territory, you must not bring back any of their sin or of their distinctive ways. A Church of Christ in Old Testament, New Testament, must be distinctive from society in general and uncontaminated and pure. It's a constantly recurring theme. Somebody said to me a couple of weeks ago, Pastor, wherever we're looking in the Pentateuch, we're seeing this same theme. Well, it's not the exclusive theme, but it does crop up almost on every page. Why do people ignore it today? That the Church of Christ must maintain its purity from the world. So don't let the world into the church, as many do, or into the home, or into your heart, or into your life. That is the purpose of the elaborate ritual washings. Sometimes I think we need them back. Please don't quote me. Don't suggest it. But sometimes I think we are so slow to learn, we need to be put through the mill of endless ritual duties to wake us up. Ah, I get it. I've got to wash my heart and purge myself. That was the reason to instill these things in the minds. In the New Testament church, God trusts us to remember his word, simply expressed. Let's be people who can be trusted and take it at its word, not needing the constant lesson of the ritual. So there are the rules for returning to camp. And I've just got time for a last theme or point. By the way, while we're on the war, there's something I forgot to tell you. Chapter 31 and verse 25. This is very beautiful. Take the sum of the prey that was taken, both of man and of beast, thou and Eleazar the priest, and the chief fathers of the congregation, and divide the prey into 2 parts, between them that took the war upon them, who went out to battle, and between all the congregation. They performed equal tasks. Those that went with sword and shield and javelin and bow, and those who remained at home doing the work. They get equal rewards, equal status, a great principle of God. Preachers are given a certain status. Prayers are given equal status. Payers are given equal status. Whatever work we do for the Lord, in any capacity, seen, unseen, we all have equal status before the Lord. That's why I'm a bit nervous about all these biographies written about preachers, and sometimes about their wives too. Why? When we all have equal status, we are all equally significant. It may be that the unseen prayers accomplish far more than the work of the pulpit, if only we knew it. So God's order is that all have equal status. And so let's just pass to, quickly, chapter 33. There's a review of the journeyings. We don't need to go into that, except that in chapter 33 and verse 50, there's an interesting statement, and I'd like to just in a couple of sentences explain it. And the Lord spake unto Moses in the plains of Moab by Jordan near Jericho. And then the command in verse 52, ye shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, and destroy all their pictures, that is their idol pictures, and destroy all their molten images of gods, and quite pluck down all their high places, dispossess the inhabitants of the land, and dwell therein. When you read a passage like that, before the children of Israel actually entered the land, these are not their marching orders. This is a predictive statement of what they are going to do. It's not going into detail. When they actually go into the promised land, the details of the marching orders is first offer terms of peace. First offer them the law of God and the blessings of God. And then, of course, in every single case, the Canaanites hate that and don't want that, and they attack with the greatest venom. And there's only one place in the entire conquest under Joshua where the Israelites are the aggressors. In every other case, they are technically the defenders, because the terms are always offered first. However, this is predictive. Sounds very blunt. Go in, attack for all you're worth, dispossess them. Sounds cruel. But when you read on, you find the actual marching orders were much more conciliatory. But the Canaanites would never have it, and so they would be dispossessed. That doesn't make the scripture contradict itself. It's quite right for the predictive summary to say what will actually happen. But it wasn't precisely the way things were conducted. So I just come to this last point, if I may. And it's in chapter 32 and verse 1. And I'll tell you a little about it. Now the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of cattle. And when they saw the land of Jazer, this is east of Jordan, it's before they've gone into the promised land, I'm sure you know about this, and the land of Gilead, that behold, the place was a place for cattle, so fertile, so wonderful, they said, let us pitch right here. We don't feel we want to go into the promised land. This will suit us just fine, east of Jordan. This is our kind of territory. This is where we can work and do everything. And Moses in this chapter gives them a tremendous dressing down. And rightly so, because they are likely to lose the blessing for everyone. And so, verse 5, they formally ask, if we have found grace in thy sight, let this land be given unto thy servants for a possession, and bring us not over Jordan. And Moses says to them, end of verse 6, shall your brethren go to war, and shall ye sit here? And wherefore discourage ye the heart of the children of Israel from going over into the land which the Lord hath given them? Thus did your fathers, the unfaithful spies, and all the people who listened to them when they shrank from going into the land. And he rehearses to them how the Lord's anger was kindled, and only two of the spies were preserved for going in to the land. Verse 14, and behold, ye are risen up in your father's stead, an increase of sinful men, to augment yet the fierce anger of the Lord toward Israel. And he warns them they'll bring about destruction. But then they promise they will, after all, send their men to fight into the land. And they'll stand by the campaign for conquest until it's complete, and only then will they return to these coveted territories they want east of Jordan. And Moses binds them to that charge. It's a wonderful passage, which I haven't time to go into in detail. Verse 23 is a tremendous verse. But if ye will not do so, says Moses to them when they make their pledge, behold, ye have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Well, dear friends, never forget, as those who've come to Christ, we are saved to serve. That's another thing some people forget when life begins to get complicated, when they turn 30 or 40, or energy starts to run out a little, perhaps at 50 or 60, and they forget. And there the Reubenites and the Gadites, whose first thought is, leave us here and you go and fight the war. And they drop out. There's a tendency, a terrible tendency, to settle down and take it easy. And Satan will egg us on in that policy and make it seem reasonable. Well, don't forget the war. Not only against personal sin, but for souls, and to protect the truth, and to keep love and trust, and to prove the Lord by prayer. The other passages here. The borders of the land are described in chapter 34. The cities of refuge, figures of mercy, in chapter 35. I'm going to pass over them. But we've looked at four points. Sins of peace, infiltration and contamination. Types of Christ. Joshua had to take the place of Moses so that our perfect, spotless lamb figure is preserved. We're appointed for war, and the tendency to settle down. Don't let it happen, dear friends. Don't let it happen. Examine your heart and your program, and never let it happen to you. Let's sing together the hymn number 400.